and his people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. The incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. This is the United Nations Happiness Index for different countries. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back two decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. Two decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year. On September 11th, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school. His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. Four suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 Fact-Finding Commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. This picture dates back to September 13, 2001, 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
These almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
All the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar, the false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else, to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye. Leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi's support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. Hundreds of dead and wounded was the result of Daesh's presence in Afghanistan.
Why was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire U.K. military budget and more than the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military, the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind, gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons. AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who could say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded, has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of demise and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's, in other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince and let him make billions of dollars off of it? That way the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, it hasn't gotten, I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, right, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952. And we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see, but if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned. Once, after 4 years of the demise of the late Allama Amini, the compiler of Al-Qadir, he came to the dreams of his son. He was in the world of Barzakh or Purgatory. His son found that Allama Amini had a beautiful place in the world of Barzakh. The son asked his father, "What is the reason for your good and beautiful place here?" Allama Amini answered, "Paying ziyara to the tomb of Hussein ibn Ali in Karbala." The son answered, "All the roads towards Karbala are closed and we cannot go there. What should we do?" Allama Amini answered, "Wherever you find the majlis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, attend there and Allah will give you the reward. Good for both the visitors of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala and those who have the chance of attending the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. O Abu Abdullah, I have come to you with all my hope. Please do not leave me alone." Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others, simply because of their race. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, disparities between black and white Americans persist in employment, wages, healthcare, voting rights, sentencing and incarceration, housing, and the building of intergenerational wealth. Jennifer Jones Austin, executive director of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, FPWA, a century-old group with deep ties to the civil rights movement, said, "Racial inequality is still recorded across nearly all measures of well-being in the U.S. today." Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others simply because of their race. Black Americans earn 20% less than their white counterparts, even with identical college degrees. This racial wealth gap has long-term detrimental impacts on families. One in three black children live in poverty, compared to less than one in 10 white children. On the surface, many of the policies and legal structures that maintain inequality have little to do with the anti-woke culture wars Republicans obsess over, especially now that the likes of DeSantis and Donald Trump have weaponized white backlash to the uprising against systematic racism and police violence that swelled in 2020. The movement for Black Lives harkens back to the 1960s, when images of police brutality in the Deep South fueled civil rights protests, and white conservatives responded to calls for desegregation with racist frenzy and banter about the state's rights. The painting of today's black and intersectional activists as anti-American and the banning of their ideas and identities in the classroom comes right out of an old right-wing playbook, creating a convenient distraction from long-standing pillars of white supremacy. A prime example, jobs and minimum wage, an issue as salient today as it was when black workers marched in 1963 to demand jobs with dignity and fair pay. Adjusted for inflation, today's federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour has less earning power than the $1.25 minimum in 1963. In fact, the minimum wage is worth less today than any time since 1956, thanks to congressional inaction by both Democrats and Republicans. Employment discrimination and underfunded K-12 schools help explain why black workers tend to be concentrated in lower-wage industries, disproportionately exposing black families to the rock-bottom federal wage floor maintained by Congress and red state legislatures. Indeed, black sanitation workers are still organizing for better wages and working conditions decades after the Memphis sanitation strike of 1968. Martin Luther King was assassinated shortly after rallying with the striking workers. Even as black people earn college degrees at significantly higher rates today, on average, they continue to face higher unemployment and lower wages than their white counterparts across all ages and educational levels, according to the report. The average black college graduate owes $25,000 more in student loan debt than their average white counterpart due to lower levels of pay for the same work, which exacerbates the wealth gap. This wealth gap between white and non-white workers remains stubbornly wide as a result, even as the wage parity improved somewhat since 1963. The median annual income among white women with college degree is 19% higher than black women with college degrees. On average, black and brown women earn $0.65 and $0.55 for every $1 earned by white men, respectively. Today, black and Latino men are concentrated in low-wage jobs more than any other group. Then, there is racist policing and the U.S. system of mass incarceration, a nexus of discrimination and institutionalized violence that many activists remain committed to abolishing 3 years after 2020 uprisings. This system has been upheld by both Republicans as well as Democrats. According to reports, in most major cities, Democratic leaders ignore widespread calls to divest from police departments and local jails and invest instead in schools, parks, healthcare, and social services to build safety in communities suffering from divestment and targeted law enforcement. As a result, black and Latino men are still disproportionately incarcerated for drugs, and black men without high school diplomas are 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts, according to the reports. For incarceration rates, the disparity is yet more severe. 1 of 3 black boys born today can expect to be sentenced to prison in their lifetime versus 1 out of 17 for their white peers, Jones Austin said, adding, "We need more aggressive policy change." Race and identity may be flashpoints in today's partisan politics in the United States, but the policies that shape racial disparities were supported by leaders in both parties, Democrats and Republicans. From decades of attacks on organized labor and neoliberal trade deals that offshored jobs in 1990s and 2000s, to the disastrous war on drugs and racist sentencing laws that filled prisons with black and brown people, both Democrats and Republicans have supported and upheld the building blocks of systematic racism. Meanwhile, Washington Times reported cities with higher numbers of black residents and more segregated neighborhoods are more likely to have mass shootings due to the effects of structural racism in the United States. And that's according to a new study. 10 researchers published a study recently in JAMA Surgery. They examined 865 mass shootings that killed 828 people and wounded 3,968 across the U.S. 51 largest metro areas from 2015 to 2019, as recorded in population-based data and the Gun Violence Archive. The study found that cities with higher percentages of black residents, higher instances of black-white neighborhood segregation, higher violent crime rates, and more single-parent black families were more likely to be affected by mass shootings, which the researchers defined as incidents that killed or wounded at least four people. The FBI also uses that definition to track the crimes.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Well, in which we are going to deal with some of the questions and answers or of jurisprudential nature related to the event of Arba'in, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Since we are approaching this special occasion of Arba'in, in which a lot of people, millions of lovers of Ahl al-Bayt and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, actually join each other, in fact, in the Arba'in Walk and participate in this such auspicious and a special event. And they go to Karbala to be a guest, in fact, for the Iraqis and Karbala and such holy cities as such. Well, we decided actually to devote a couple of these episodes, inshallah, to the Islamic laws which are related to the Arba'in. And Sheikh Javid, let me start by asking you this question. What is the significance of Arba'in in the eyes or in the opinion of His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei?
Well, Arba'in is indeed an excellent occasion to think over the meaning of the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And obviously millions of people gather for Arba'in procession on the way to Karbala, carrying colorful black flags, some wearing black, some wearing, their own typical dresses. And this very movement displays the magnificence mm-hmm. of Imam Hussein's path, his movement and his uprising against injustice, of course. Now, speaking from the Sharia perspective, it is recommended to visit the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, especially during Arba'in, to read the ziyara of Imam Hussein, to mourn for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, as did the early noble companions of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, like Jabir bin Abdullah Ansari, who reportedly visited the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam on the 40th day of his martyrdom.
Yes.
Now, this very occasion is documented, it is narrated in our sources. Obviously, when it comes to Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion and perspective, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran has on different occasions pointed to this event. For example, in one of the public speeches posted on his website, www.khameneiir.ir, of course, he says, have you seen that gathering? Have you seen that the great movement comprised of millions of people between Najaf and Karbala. Have you seen the movement between Najaf and Imam Hussein and Karbala? And he goes on asking this such questions. So he says, have you seen that excitement and enthusiasm? So he further says, this should be preserved, this movement and this Arba'in procession, Arba'in rally should be preserved. This is what, he says that this is what guarantees the survival of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has spoken and elaborated on the significance of Arba'in procession in Arba'in rally during on different occasions, and also during his Darse Kharij, for example, dated November 6, 2017, he has said, as it is posted on his website, he says, it is the time of Arba'in, a good time for those who are in the middle of their walk, or those who will participate in the walk, joining the Arba'in pilgrimage for reciting the beautiful ziyarah of the day of Arba'in, God willing, addressing our great Imam Hussein. And, he says, thank God our youth have found the path. Millions of people from our country, from Iraq and other countries, move in this direction. The walk of Arba'in represents one of the extraordinary events
mm-hmm.
that the Almighty God granted us and created for us. It has become an emblem. The walk of Arba'in existed always, but there was not this great movement, a magnificent and beautiful emblem of followers and lovers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. We didn't have this. The Almighty God blessed us and gave this to us. We should be grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unquote, of course.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let me stop you there actually for a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential questions and answers and Islamic laws related to the Arba'in event and pilgrimage with Sheikh Javid. Considering the current geopolitical circumstances, Sheikh Javid, can we say that the Arba'in event or pilgrimage is somehow obligatory in this day and age?
Well, as I mentioned, Arba'in rally, or the Arba'in rally, is a great event. It shows, it is an opportunity for Muslims to show their unity, their solidarity, and their togetherness.
Mm-hmm.
So the Arba'in pilgrimage is a highly commendable and mustahab act that Shia Muslims or Muslims across the world can actually observe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Arba'in rally is truly an unprecedented event, not only in our times but also in history.
Mm-hmm.
We do not know of anything similar, of any or gathering similar to it in history, which is organized more warmly every year. So it is kind of, it has no match or no precedence, actually. So Let me read a quote from the Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says, "The logic of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wasalam is the logic of defending the truth and resistance against oppression, transgression, deviation, and arrogance." This is the logic of Imam Hussein. Today, the world needs this logic.
Right.
Today, the world is witness to the rule of kufr, arrogance, and corruption. The world is witness to the rule of oppression. The message of Imam Hussein is the salvation of the world. The great movement of Arba'in conveys this message to the whole world, and by Allah's favor and grace, this movement should be strengthened on a daily basis. So as we see, this Arba'in rally gains more fervor, more, you know,
yes,
enthusiasm with each day passing and with each year passing. Of course, millions and millions of people are take part in this procession with so enthusiasm that is, I believe, inexplicable.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and attention to the questions that are raised regarding this special event, the Arba'in pilgrimage. And thank you very much for listening to us. Please remember us in your du'as, especially in such special occasions, when especially you participate in the Arba'in walk and when you actually pay a visit and ziyarah of the third Shiite imam for which the martyrdom of, or for the martyrdom of whom, in fact, you went on this spiritual journey. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's parted way awaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
BRICS group of emerging nations invites six countries, including Iran, to become new members of the bloc. Russia says an investigation has been launched into a plane crash that left the commander of the Wagner group and his deputy dead. Also coming up, China strongly criticizes Japan's move to release treated radioactive water.